The Tom Woods Show, episode 1878.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. I am delighted to welcome back to the show Jay Bhattacharya, who's a professor of medicine at Stanford University and one of the three illustrious drafters of the heroic anti-lockdown Great Barrington Declaration, which we've talked about numerous times on this program. And I just knew I would have a whole bunch of listener questions for Professor Bhattacharya. So I solicited them inside the Tom Woods Show Elite, membership in which can be accessed via supportinglisteners.com. Jay, welcome back to the show.
Oh, nice to be back.
I just have to put it to you just bluntly this way. How has the past year changed you?
From a personal point of view, it's a lot of friendships that I had built up over many, many years have been broken. I've made incredible new friends. I don't really know exactly what that means. I hope I get some of my old friends back at some point, but I didn't realize how fragile some of those friendships were. Professionally, it's been an amazing experience. I mean, I didn't realize I was sort of preparing for thinking about events like this my entire life, but it feels like I have. I mean, I feel like I've used a lot of what I spent my life working on in thinking about this pandemic. You know, not always getting it right, but I think pretty productively. So I think it's been, I mean, I don't know what the future holds, but I don't think I can go back to exactly what I did in the past.
Do you feel like what we've seen indicates that either public health is simply broken or there's just something fundamentally rotten at the heart of it?
I think the problem is it's not public health so much as the role of public health in society. Public health has an absolutely important role to play. I mean, they're talking about the goal of public health essentially is human flourishing. But the problem is that when public health focuses on a single aspect of human health and ignores every other aspect of human well-being, it's going to get things very, very, very wrong, as we've seen through this epidemic. And I think that what should have happened is that public health should have played a role, but it should have played a role in the context of other disciplines that are also focused on human flourishing. Economics is, believe it or not, focused on human flourishing. The idea of trade-offs in policy is fundamental in thinking about this epidemic, and yet public health has ignored that fact in many, many, many of its decisions, I think catastrophically so. So it's more the elevation of public health beyond its capacities as opposed to public health itself.
It's funny, the one video I really got in trouble for, even though there's, you know, as I'm sure you know, nothing wrong with the video, one of the criticisms of it was that I claimed that the public health establishment was not acknowledging the collateral effects of lockdowns. And the fact checker said, no, look, the World Health Organization said in October that it acknowledged there were problems. October! So 7 months in, and the best you can do is say, yeah, 7 months later, they did recognize there was something wrong. Okay, you got me. You got me. They did make a statement 7 months in, but I think that kind of makes my point.
Tom, is that it's not just a statement. It needs to be the absolute dead center of how they think about this thing. There are no free lunches, right? That's the dictum of economics, the main dictum. I mean, that's what attracted me to economics in the first place, is that dictum. And yet public health has acted as if the lockdowns were a free lunch. They're still acting like that. The vaccines are not enough to obviate the need for the lockdowns, apparently, is what I've learned in the last couple of days. I mean, it's absolute nonsense. You have to think about these trade-offs sort of as a core part of your thinking, as a core part. I mean, you have to just incorporate into your soul before you start opining on these or even thinking about making decisions for other people on the basis of these kinds of policies. And they just have not done that.
When I found out I was able to get you back on, I solicited some questions for you from my supporters group. And I do want to run through a few of those. And they're questions that I think we all have and surrounding which there is at least some uncertainty. So the first one has to do with just how widespread so-called asymptomatic spread is. I mean, we'll remember that at the very beginning of all this, Dr. Fauci quite memorably said that although we can't rule out the possibility of asymptomatic spread, he says that in any pandemic, it is always a symptomatic person who drives it. Now, that statement, like so many early statements, has just been completely forgotten. And I think he does think asymptomatic spread is at least significant problem. And yet I hear other people saying it's no real problem at all. How is the layman to make sense of that?
So there's two distinct issues there. So first is what fraction of the cases or the infections that happen result in asymptomatic, basically nothing, right? So you have the virus, you don't have any symptoms, you clear it and you're done with the disease. You're immune now, more or less, to reinfection, you know, for a considerable time. How common is that? And I think there's some dispute in the literature. The early seroprevalence studies I did, it was somewhere in the order of 40% of infections were like that. I think somewhere in the order of 20 to 40% of infections are asymptomatic. So that's one question. The next question is, how common is it that someone who is asymptomatic spreads the disease to other people?
Yeah.
That's the key question, right? And there, I think we have a pretty good answer. And the answer is it's very, very rare. So just to give you a sense of what the literature is saying, there's a fantastic study, I think published in January of this year, in the Journal of American Medical Association. There was a meta-analysis of 50-some studies, if I remember the number right, of so essentially like household transmission of the disease. Like, you know, so if you have, you're identified as an infection and you obviously live in a house, maybe with some other people, well, how likely is it that you spread the disease to other people living in the same house, presumably unmasked, presumably in intimate settings where you're just intermingling about social distancing, right? Unless you live in a very weird family, I guess. So the result was that 7 out of 1,000 times an asymptomatic case passes it on to someone else, a family member. If you're symptomatic and you live in the house with some other people, it's 18 out of 100 or 180 out of 1,000 times. You know, it's more than 20 times more, something like 20 times more. Yeah, it's more than 20 times more more common to pass it on if you're a symptomatic case than an asymptomatic case. It's really unlikely that you'll pass it on. It's not zero, but it's also not, you know, if you're symptomatic. I mean, what that brings in mind is like, you know, a really simple policy that we could have adopted, but didn't, which is to, I mean, actually, this is what Sweden did. If you just recommend very, very, very strongly, if you are sick, stay at home and try to isolate from your family members as best you can. If you are not sick, live your life because the lockdown harms are so high. The disease spread, even with the lockdowns, right? We had this like notion of the lockdown stopping the disease from spreading as if we are capable of ending all normal human interactions for an extended, for a year and some. But of course, that's not the reality of human beings' existence. We're always going to have to interact with one another. So the disease will spread. The lockdowns are not a tool to stop the disease and never have been.
I did hear something like the statistic you just gave of 18 out of 100 when we're talking about a symptomatic person within the household. I had heard something like that. Now, when we've been told every time I see the CDC's line, let's say at a restaurant or some public place, a museum, they'll say COVID-19 is an extremely infectious disease and it spreads very easily. I don't know what to compare that number to because 18% when I'm constantly surrounded by these people, I mean, surrounded by them and I interact with them on a daily basis very closely, 18% strikes me as low. And I guess partly the reason I've been thinking about this is that if there's only I don't know if I'm really stating it the right way, but if there's only, let's say, an 18% chance that somebody in my household is showing symptoms of it and I catch it, then there's 0% chance of a jogger on the street passing by me and giving it to me. And there's a 0% chance. If hanging around hours and hours and days with a symptomatic person, is 18% actually high or is it as low as a layman like me thinks it is?
I mean, high. I guess the highest question is relative to what the harm is on the other side of getting sick, right? So 18% is a high number if the disease is really deadly for you. I mean, I wouldn't want to expose myself to an 18% risk of a disease.
That's true.
So I think, so 18% is, I mean, and given that we know older people are vulnerable to this disease, it's a high enough number that you would take some actions to try to reduce it as much as you can. But you're absolutely right, Tom. Jogging past somebody on the street, you are not going to get COVID. It is exceedingly unlikely. Like there's trillions of interactions like that that have occurred since the beginning of the pandemic. And a vanishingly small number of cases actually contracted that way, where you can say, really, really, this is where I got it from. We've made policy on the basis of epsilon risk, to avoid epsilon risk at the cost of enormous collateral damage. I mean, it's just like as if we didn't realize what the trade-offs were. We forgot how to do standard risk analysis.
Well, by the way, I raise that number not because I think it's trivial to a person, let's say, who is vulnerable and could get really sick, but rather that I think compared to what the average person probably thinks, they probably think it's like an 80% chance. So therefore, they think that in a casual setting like a restaurant, well, it must be 25% or something like that. So this false baseline they have in their heads about the likelihood of household transmission informs the way they think about all other sorts of social settings. So if the initial high and the initial number in their minds is too high, then everything else is going to be too high. That was what I meant.
Yeah, no, Tom, you're absolutely right about that. I completely agree with that. That notion that this 18% number, people do overestimate that risk of disease spread. And it's very unfortunate because they end up hurting themselves and others by acting in out of this fear. That fear actually, I think, drives the demand for the lockdowns. It's basically at the root of all of the pathology and policy that we've seen. I completely agree with what you just said. Why not just tell people, if you're sick, stay home and isolate yourself? Then you can go to a restaurant. It's just mainly filled with asymptomatic people. People are not going to want to spread the disease. They're wearing masks to stop the spread of the disease outdoors and alone in a car. If you just tell them instead, say, if you're sick, stay home. I just don't understand. Like, that kind of basic advice would have gone quite a long way.
I have a question from a physician, and she says, I work with a lot of other physicians. I have a lot of physician friends, and they all follow the current, quote, science. So double masking, belief in lockdowns, eager to vaccinate their young, healthy children. My colleagues are young and healthy. I feel like I'm living in an alternate reality. I just started my first job out of fellowship, and while I discuss mask efficacy and lockdowns with patients, I'm certainly not as outspoken as I would be if I were more established. I'm so appreciative of everything you're doing. How do you get through the days with your colleagues who feel so differently about things? And do you have any advice on ways to reach people who view things so differently than we do? Also, are there any reputable organizations or movements that I could join or other tangible things I can do to help get the truth out there?
So that's a hard question because there has been this sort of demonization of any skepticism at all around the policies. And people that have sort of voiced their thoughts about this have paid enormous costs. I mean, I assume that would motivate you're asking me to start how personally I felt around this.
Yeah.
And I think that it has unfortunately led, just like your listeners, to a lot of silencing of people who have deep doubts about this. I actually think that the majority of doctors agree with this skepticism about lockdowns. I think the majority of scientists are thinking to themselves, this doesn't make sense, because it doesn't make sense. But because the megaphone is controlled by people who are the architects of this policy, they've managed to silence large numbers of people. A lot of what I've been motivated to keep speaking about is to give people permission just to talk. But for someone who's just starting on their career, I've gotten lots of emails, Tom, from people who have spoken up, you know, young people in settings just like your listener, and they've gotten reprisals. One just recent email I got from an epidemiologist in Belgium who's fired from his job because he spoke up against lockdowns on Belgian national TV. You know, a professor. It's a very, very bad environment for this kind of, to me, I don't see any other choice. I'm willing to pay the cost to speak up, even if it gets censored. I think I kind of feel like I have some obligation for that. And I think everybody has to make their own personal choice. That you shouldn't go into it blind, though. It's no easy way to do this, given the environment. I will say this, I'm hopeful. I don't think this kind of environment can last for a very long time in a liberal society like ours. I think the roots of free exchange of ideas are too deep in American society for it to continue in this way. And I think most of the reason why this has happened is the fear. And once the fear starts to dissipate, and I think it's on its way with the vaccines, I hope that we can get back to sort of who we ourselves. I mean, we can go back to arguing about the deficit or something. It'll be fun.
Yeah. I actually miss those days now. Yeah. Of course, this all calls to mind we don't have to get into in any detail what's been going on YouTube, and you yourself have had material taken down when you were at the roundtable with Governor DeSantis, and YouTube decided that it was important that a roundtable of experts advising a major U.S. governor, that just be kept secret from the public. That's the best approach to take. And it seems to me like YouTube is acting as if the progress of science occurs with the ossification of heterodoxies, orthodoxies. We have orthodoxies that take shape, and we defend those orthodoxies, and we silence outside voices, and that is not at all the case. And in fact, a lesson right from this episode right now is early on with ventilators. Ventilators seem to be the go-to thing with a lot of COVID patients. And I remember watching a very amateur YouTube video by a doctor made in his home saying, I think this is a mistake. The over-reliance on ventilators may actually be counterproductive. Now, thank goodness the science police weren't already in force then. They would have shut him down. That was not the consensus. But he turned out to be right.
Yeah. No, I think science can't work when you have this environment of censorship and recrimination for people who dissent. You know, I might be wrong. It's possible, right? I mean, I've been wrong about lots of things in my life. The issue isn't whether I'm right or wrong. The issue is I think of science like a dialectical process, right? So, you know, you think that lockdowns don't work. I think lockdowns work. Well, there's some empirical implications that we can both agree on that should happen if you're right. And let's all look at them. So is Florida a disaster area? Is it doing much worse palpably than other similar states? Well, then the answer is no. That means I'm wrong. Lockdowns didn't work because Florida didn't adopt a lockdown. California did, right? So that's the way science works. You have a thesis, an antithesis, and then you look at evidence, decide which is right, and you arrive at the synthesis. And then we start disagreeing about another thing, you know, mass or whatever it is, right? So the point is that there's this process requires that people can freely say, no, Tom, you're not right. Or no, Jay, you're not right. And then we can look at evidence together and argue about whether whose view is closer to the evidence, right? I mean, I think that's the only way science can work. And to undercut that in this pandemic has been probably the single biggest mistake. Well, maybe the lockdowns. I mean, I will weigh in the balance, which is worse for humanity in the long run. But both have been utterly disastrous.
Well, especially when you think of how unprecedented lockdowns on this scale are. And that they do seem to run counter to everything we know about pandemic preparedness and stuff, you would think that it can't be the case that they are automatically assumed to be correct and effective. How would we know that? We've never tried anything like this before. So of all things that we would want robust discussion of, you would think a radical break with the past like this with far-reaching implications, we're just going to automatically assume that that's the right thing to do automatically without even looking at it? I mean, that's the shocking part to me.
Yeah, I mean, it was an experiment tried on the entire world population, more or less, with absolutely no informed consent, no democratic process to decide whether we're going to go into this or not. It was just assumed that it was going to work. We had no choice. You had to flatten the curve 2 weeks and then into 13 months, I guess.
What can you tell us about the variants and how concerned people should be? I mean, Fauci has been fairly, I mean, it's hard to nail him down, but I've seen a lot of people who have been, let's say, fairly pessimistic this whole time, who have come out and said, the variants are being overblown. They're not as big of a problem as people are saying. So what do you think?
I agree with that. I mean, if you look at the literature, there's two key things that I've been looking at in the literature about the variants. One is, and this is probably the most important thing, do the variants escape natural immunity if you had previous infection, do the variants escape immunity to the vaccines? Those are the two things. And the answer is no in both cases. I guess the third thing is are the variants more deadly? And the answer is it doesn't appear to be palpably more deadly. And it certainly doesn't change the age gradient of who's most vulnerable to the disease. The variants have that same age gradient. You know, this thing, the virus mutates, has been mutating since the day it was released into the population. Tens of thousands of or more mutations have happened already to this virus, most of which do nothing to the virus or maybe make it, you know, sort of less good at infecting and killing people. So I don't, and the variants that have survived, you kind of expect when you're reaching sort of a large portion of the population already immune to the virus, you expect that the mutations with a small selective advantage would take over the few remaining cases. And I think that's roughly what we're seeing. You know, like take in the UK, the B.1.1.7 variant arises there sometime in mid-December, I think, and right as the caseload declines very sharply. And somehow we're supposed to think this is going to restart the epidemic. It was a bad prediction then. And if someone's making that kind of prediction now, it's still a bad prediction. The variants don't change anything fundamental. You don't do a lockdown. You do focused protection. And with the vaccine, we can do pretty close to perfect focused protection.
I had Eric Topol on the show to debate Martin Kulldorff a few months ago.
And you heard that. That was a great show, Tom.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. Now, he had a chart or a graph showing where he projected the case numbers were going to go because of B.1.1.7. And it just went in exactly the opposite direction of what he predicted. Now, nobody's perfect. I mean, our people have made predictions that didn't come true. It's just that if our people make predictions that don't come true, the media would just harp on it forever. Whereas we get all kinds of crazy predictions from Fauci or Joe Biden or whatever, and then nothing happens, and then we just move on. I mean, the Texas Rangers game is not, certainly it seems to me very unlikely it's going to lead to much of anything, but no one's going to follow up and say, maybe we created unnecessary panic. You know, no one seems to follow up with that. It seems to be a double standard in how we're treated. Yeah, I know this comes as a surprise.
Yeah. I mean, there certainly has been. I mean, there's been this asymmetry. Like, the idea is that spreading fear is responsible because then it'll get people to take the pandemic seriously, as if it's possible to have people take it any more seriously than they already do.
I know. Yeah, it's crazy. But on the other hand, by the way, I'm seeing a lot of musical acts with full tour schedules starting late summer and fall. I don't think every single one of those is going to cancel. I think some large events are going to happen.
Okay, so this is, should I make this prediction? I'll just make this prediction.
Please.
I think by the fall, we'll have something very, very close to normality, even in California, which is fully locked down. And many places in the U.S., I think we're almost already there. But I think the key thing I think that drives the fear is the deaths and hospitalizations.
Right.
80% of people who are older than 65 in the U.S. have at least had the first dose of the Pfizer, Moderna, or maybe the J&J vaccine. 80%. Given those numbers, once that population is fully vaccinated, the cases and the deaths and hospitalizations will decouple from one another. And so you count cases, but they don't result in hospitalization deaths. Where's the fear? If you look at the seroprevalence data worldwide, the infection fatality rate for people under 70 is 0.05%, you know, 99.95% survival post-infection. Now, I mean, I don't think that that will, with numbers like that, you're not going to be able to engineer the fear that resulted in the demand for the lockdowns, the antisocial behavior that sort of become endemic, this sort of like institutionalization of hypochondria, I think will start to dissipate.
Oh, I love that expression, the institutionalization of hypochondria. That's a good one. Did you know the other two great Barrington Declaration scientists before all this began?
I didn't. In fact, they're two of the folks I had in mind as some of the new friends I've made. I mean, they're like family to me now. But I did not know them before this epidemic. I had used some of Martin's work in some of my own work that I'd done previously. I mean, he's a brilliant biostatistician. But I hadn't known him personally.
It's interesting to follow him, by the way, because I think if you were to sit back and read his Twitter feed, but particularly the replies he makes to others over the course of the past year, let's just say he's become gradually spicier and spicier as things have happened to him. He hits right back at people. He had somebody accusing you guys of, I don't know, stalking him or hounding him or harassing his employer about him. And Kohldorf simply said, look, none of us even know who you are. Okay, I don't even know. I don't know what this is about, but I assure you, I am not spending any time on whoever you are. Crazy, crazy stuff going on out there. So somebody wants to know, do you personally, in your own work, have you had direct experience with the CDC, the National Institutes of Health, and what's that been like? Has it been okay?
Almost all of my work in the past has been funded by the National Institute of Health, in particular, the National Institute of Aging. And I mean, I think it's a great institution. It has the capacity to enable many, many scientists to do work that they wouldn't otherwise be able to do. I think it's a hugely good investment. But just like anything, even good things, it has costs. I think we've started seeing that in this epidemic, right? So the head of the NIAID, the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, is Anthony Fauci. The head of an agency like that wields enormous power over the agenda of the agency. And many, many, many infectious disease doctors and researchers, very top people in the field, rely on those NIAID grants. I didn't actually tend to rely on NIAID grants. Most of my work is in aging, so it's the National Institute of Aging, which generally has been freer about this, so it has a much less heavy hand than NIAID. And I think that, I mean, in the back of my head, I haven't seen this like documented, so I don't, maybe it's not right, but in the back of my head, I've had the sense that like, maybe now we should view NIAID funding as a conflict of interest that needs to be, you know, sort of taken into account when you're reading, you know, the opinions about lockdown for someone about that with that background.
Can you think of any other episode in, let's say, your lifetime involving health in which there were, in effect, two distinct sides that vilified each other, that it wasn't just a matter of, I've reached this conclusion, you've reached that conclusion, let's go back and re-examine it, but it really became a vilification campaign and people were afraid to speak out, or is this something new?
I mean, Martin Kulldorff says this is the end of the Age of Enlightenment, 300 years, right? The Age of Enlightenment started with this vilification episode of Galileo, right? Is that 300 years ago? I should know my history better. In any case, I think that we kind of had developed norms where you could have disagreements within science without this kind of vilification. I mean, I think you've seen some episodes like this with, you know, in the Soviet Union with Lysenko and Darwinian evolution, the vilification of Darwinianists, or more recently in the U.S. and elsewhere about any dissent over climate change science. So I think it's not like unprecedented in history, but certainly, I mean, I've never seen it in my own work. I mean, it's never, the field I've been in has been characterized by lots of disagreements, health economics. And it's, I think, really healthy to have those disagreements. A healthy field has these kinds of disagreements followed by, you know, some good empirical work to try to decide which views are right. And then you move on to the next thing. I think that this is the problem here is that this particular scientific disagreement has affected every single person on the face of the earth negatively and made it impossible, close to impossible, to have a rational discussion so we can decide whether if we're doing the right thing or the wrong thing. And as a result, we just followed this policy, this lockdown, most of the world has followed this lockdown policy without actually having had a chance to have the debate that would have helped us realize whether it's a good or bad thing. I mean, that was, again, part of the reason for the Great Barrington Declaration was to really just to restart this debate. Because if I'm honest, I don't think there's anything new in the Great Barrington Declaration. It's a restatement of the old pandemic plans.
Yeah, and in fact, I'm pretty sure if you go back on Twitter and look in the very, very early months of all this, you can find some of the people who later became your antagonists early on kind of groping toward that position. And then when the other position became the established one, all of a sudden it was like they had never said the other thing before, that everybody just jumped on that bandwagon so rapidly.
On the basis of no evidence. I mean,
yeah,
like
right.
What evidence came out was like the Imperial College model. That's not evidence. That's a model with 5 million assumptions, many of which have turned out to be, in retrospect, not quite right. So I think it was fear. It wasn't science that drove the switch to lockstep support for the lockdowns. It was fear.
People want to know about these vaccines. And I hear people, here's the thing. I have no background in any of this. I'm a historian, but I have a level of intelligence where I can look at graphs of different places. And if I'm told that we're facing a threat that's so catastrophic that it justifies impoverishing people, burning through their savings, causing all kinds of other collateral health problems, whatever, then I better be able to see the effects of the mitigation measures clearly on the charts, and I'd better be able to see massive outbreaks when in the absence of these measures. And if I look, for example, I'm actually putting together a quiz where people are going to have graphs and the states aren't going to be labeled, and they have to pick which is the one with the heavier mitigation measures, and of course they won't be able to. But I'm going to do a pin the Thanksgiving on the Midwest, because the Midwest did not spike during Thanksgiving. It spiked at another time right around Thanksgiving. But all at once, apparently everybody in the Midwest simultaneously must have decided to follow the public health measure. I mean, something else is going on here. So I intend to do stuff like that.
I mean, that's science, Tom, right? That's what you're doing is science, right? You're saying you have one view, lockdowns are drive the spread and lack of compliance to lockdowns drive the spread. You have another view, which is the disease spreads regionally and seasonally. And if you think view A about lockdowns is right, then one ought to be able to tell the difference between those graphs. If view B is right, then you're going to have a much harder time. So I think it's so clear at this point that lockdowns cannot be the primary explanation for the changes in the caseloads and whatnot of this virus.
Right.
This is a virus that spreads regionally and seasonally.
Right. Well, so the reason I bring this all up is I'm not pretending to be an epidemiologist. I'm not pretending to be a public health expert. I'm just a guy who wants to know what the explanation is behind these charts, or at least for people to say, as Andy Slavitt said on MSNBC, Andy Slavitt, when he was asked, what's the deal here? California and Florida are almost indistinguishable, and yet Florida's mostly open, has a much older population. I mean, you would think it would be the opposite. And he was reduced to saying, well, there are a lot of things about this virus that are a little bit beyond our ability to understand. That was all I wanted them to say, was just to admit I know it seems like we have incredible certainty given how robustly we're imposing these measures, but a lot of this still is elusive. That was really all I wanted to hear. Well, likewise, I don't know anything about vaccines, and I'm never going to, in my available time, I'll never be able to learn enough that some other person who knows more couldn't come along and refute. So I have to rely on people I trust. And I'm hearing some people telling me the vaccines are actually very good and the numbers do look very good. They seem to be very effective. I have other people saying whether they're good or not, they're not really vaccines in the traditional sense because of X, Y, and Z. Can you try and sort this out for lay people?
Sure. So I think both are true. So first, these are fantastic vaccines, Tom. And I have to say, like, if you ask me at the beginning of the epidemic, would it be possible to develop this kind of technology so quickly, get it tested and mass produced in the way, in the speed that we've done it? I don't think I would have said yes. In fact, I know I wouldn't have said yes. But for, especially for older people for whom COVID is such a deadly disease, they are such a great idea. They're a godsend because the side effect profiles, I mean, they're not perfect. No vaccine is perfect in the side effect profiles, but it's low enough that the risk of COVID dwarfs the risk of the side effects of the vaccine. I think you get to a certain age where that's no longer true. And I don't know what that age is, where the side, I'd say don't take it if the side effects, if you're a kid, I mean, it's not clear to me that the vaccines are overwhelmingly better than COVID for a very, very young person. So there's some age cutoff in between where the vaccines turn from, you know, sort of just, you'd be indifferent between them. But it's interesting, like almost all of the discussion around the policy has ignored this age gradient, right? So the lockdowns are this unfocused policy that quarantines young and healthy people in the hopes of stopping the virus from spreading, ignoring the age gradient, say, why not just do focus protection of the old? Same thing with the vaccine distribution, right? So actually, one thing we did right, most states did actually prioritize the old first for the vaccines. And that's a good thing. I mean, that's why we're sort of starting to see this decoupling of cases and deaths. I think the moral case for vaccinating the young in the U.S. first is terrible. But even now that we've vaccinated many of the older, a large fraction of the older population, I mean, I kind of think we want to send these vaccine doses overseas to older people outside the U.S. who need them way more than, you know, say a 25-year-old American who's at very low risk of death. I mean, we can discuss exactly when that is. Now, you also had a second statement, which is that the vaccines are a novel technology. And they are a novel technology, right? This, especially the mRNA vaccines, are really novel technology. It's a normal, like traditional vaccines introduce an antigen into your bloodstream and then your immune system reacts to it, produces an immune response that makes you immune to the virus that has that antigen present. This vaccine, what it does is, let's take the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines, it introduces an mRNA strand, which then essentially, in effect, infects a cell. The mRNA strand isn't taken up into the nucleus of the cells, not incorporate the DNA. It's just the mRNA is then turned into the spike protein that's expressed on the cell. Then your immune system finds those things and turns to be very effective at finding those spike proteins that are produced on the cell surface. And it produces a lasting immune response. It acts like a vaccine, although it's not exactly the same mechanism as traditional vaccine.
Then why is it then, I mean, with a traditional vaccine, we don't generally have the question of, if you get the vaccine, we don't know if you could still wind up getting whatever the disease is and then transmitting it to somebody else. But with these vaccines, that does seem to be in doubt. Why would that be?
It's true with the traditional vaccines too. There's a big discussion around every time there's a new vaccine. How effective is it as reducing spread? How effective is it at neutralizing infections? How complete is the protection? I mean, very few vaccines are 100% effective in both. So it's, finding the right antigen that works, getting your immune system to respond to it appropriately and producing lasting immunity it tends to be an art actually, rather than like a specific, I mean, obviously science is involved. And so that's what stunned me about this. Like we sort of got to the right antigen almost immediately. We produced a delivery mechanism that produces a lasting immune response. Again, almost immediately, we tested it at scale, I mean, within months, and then deployed it within a year. It's an actually remarkable achievement.
Can we close with the issue of vaccine passports? If I remember correctly, you and Professor Kohldorf jointly wrote an article on this. If the vaccines are effective and they do the things that people hoped they would do, then isn't it a small thing to ask people to do this because you would thereby contribute to herd immunity and bring everything to an end? I mean, look, you already know what the argument is, but what's the problem with that?
Well, I mean, think about what a vaccine passport actually is doing. It's saying, like, we're going to divide society into two, if you have the vaccine or not. And we're going to deny access to normal human things if you haven't had the vaccine. Well, you know, I think 120 to 170 million people somewhere in there have been already infected with COVID and are immune. they don't really need the vaccine to pose no risk at all to anybody else. We're going to deny them access to airports. We're going to deny them access to restaurants, to sporting events, to schools. I mean, are we really going to? I mean, it's like Jim Crow, right? You're reintroducing this sort of division on the basis of some measurable thing. And then you're saying you can't have access to society on the basis of not having this measurable thing. It's a very, very coercive, unequal thing, especially since the set of people who've been infected they tend to be the people who haven't, you know, essential workers and poor people, working class, who have not had the luxury of being staying home during the lockdown. So I think it's very, very unequal and unfair. The second thing I'd say is it's bad for public health, right? Because it's completely reasonable. I mean, if I'm somebody's looking at this and doesn't know a ton about vaccines, I'm going to say, well, if you say the vaccines are so good, Jay, why are you forcing me to get them? Why don't you? I mean, my reaction will be, you're trying to pull something over on me. It's very bad for public health. It sort of creates this distrust of public health and a completely reasonable distrust for public health when you employ these kinds of coercive measures as opposed to just telling people, here's what the data show. A good example of this is the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. You know, you have this system that finds 6 cases of CVST, this thrombosis event, in millions of people that have had it. The 6 all are under the age of 50, right? What's the right way to deal with that? You trust people. You say, look, for people under the age of 50, we've discovered this 1 in a million event, and here's the risk of COVID if you were to get it. You make your own decision what to do. I think people will mostly do the right thing, as opposed to creating the distrust. You know, you have to get the vaccine or you can't participate in normal life. The vaccine passports are a guaranteed way to create distrust and dissension, which will make public health work much more difficult.
Well, one last thing related to that, because I have a friend, I think it might be Phil Magnus at AIER, but I'm not entirely sure, who refers to Dr. Fauci as the nation's leading vaccine skeptic. Because he gets the vaccine and then he says, I'm not going to restaurants, I'm not going on any trips, I'm not going to do this, that, or the other thing. And people are responding to that with, then what would lead somebody to get this vaccine if it means, you know, that, if it means you're just going to continue in this way? But couldn't he come back and say, well, just as you, Jay Bhattacharya, said, with any vaccine, we need some time to see how good it is at doing X and Y, and I'm just trying to be, you know, mindful of safety and measure risks and benefits and wait for the numbers to come in. Is there anything wrong with his approach?
I guess if you have that point of view, you're risk averse in that, to that extent, I'd ask you to be consistent in your risk aversion to that extent. And maybe Fauci is, I don't know him personally. As someone who has the position he has, where people are looking to him for leadership around this, and given what the most likely outcome is from this vaccine, given the data that we've had up to now, it is absolutely safe to interact with other people after you've had especially the second dose and waited a week. I mean, there's absolutely almost vanishingly small likelihood that you're going to get COVID from it. And if you do get COVID again, it's almost certainly to be a very mild infection, not a severe outcome. That's what the now tens of millions of people have been vaccinated, and that's what we've seen. Even in the early days of the vaccine, 30,000, tens of thousands of people have been vaccinated, we saw something very similar. So I think he is reacting to vanishingly small risks and changing his life in ways. Fine, I don't have any argument with someone. You know, if he views that risk as particularly salient, fine, it's up to him. I'm not boss of him. But the problem is that he is a role model for hundreds of millions of people. And to act that way creates skepticism of the vaccine. Phil Magnus is absolutely right. He is the number one vaccine skeptic in the United States. He's done more for the anti-vax movement than anyone else that I know of.
Wow. That's a heck of a thing to say. I guess I want to close with this, and I don't want you to say anything one way or the other, whether you know if this is going to happen or not, but it seems to me that somebody needs to persuade Scott Atlas to write a book about his White House experience, telling everything, naming names, and also talking about whose approach worked and whose didn't. He's got the name recognition, the credibility. He's got the reputation that needs to be restored. If he's not working on that book, then the world makes no sense to me. I'm just going to leave that there.
Tom, can I give you news to you, Joe, your audience? He's writing it.
Oh, is he really?
He's really writing it. It's going to be fantastic.
Oh, so happy. That is so, so great. Oh, that's so great. Jeez, I would love to be the publisher that snagged that deal. That is so great. Yeah. Well, anyway, listen, I don't want to take any more of your time, but I appreciate, as I say, I had a bunch of listener questions. I just wanted to check in with you because after that YouTube fiasco, I just could, you know, I had a video taken down, but it was on somebody else's channel. Then I had it's not really a video. I put all my podcast episodes on YouTube. So it's just the audio with a still shot. And that one had this fellow Ivor Cummins on, and they took that down, I think, in large part because I think they may have tagged his name. So they review everything that comes up with his name. And I guess what bothers me, but I know I should just let it, you know, roll off me and it's no big deal and it happens to everybody. But, you know, honestly, I think of myself as a serious thinker, and you're highly credentialed in this particular area. So I don't like being treated like some wacko. And that's in effect how I feel when this happens.
Tom, it's exactly what it is. It's an effort to essentially, I mean, they can't really stop the ideas from getting out. What is it is an editorial decision to say, look, you're wrong. It's so wrong that we're going to not let you be on our channel. And it's to tar you with this like brush of like some saying crazy things, right? The problem is that they have not made the argument. They have not made actually the argument that we're saying crazy things, that we're wrong. If we're wrong, show us. And then I'll change my mind if you show me, and if you show me the evidence. I promise you I will. I'm built that way, and it's part of my training, right? I know you are too, Tom. It's the same way, right? If YouTube showed you the evidence that this wasn't right, and you agreed with the evidence, you'd say this wasn't right. We got that wrong. Instead, they skip a step. They jump to you are not allowed to speak on our channel because you're so dangerous. It's a non sequitur. Instead of actually arguing with you, they're going to try to brush you in this way. That's really the problem. It's not that they can stop you from people from hearing you. It's that sort of skipping of the step of the intellectual argument that would allow them to say you're wrong. So I think this YouTube censorship thing is, I mean, I, you know, the funny thing is the videos they censored were actually of news channels covering the event. And then NBC wrote a story essentially favorable to YouTube in favor of YouTube censoring news channels. I mean, it's the most extraordinary thing. I can't, there's something wrong with American democracy if the media is cheering on censorship of the media. I mean, there's just like, they don't understand that it could come back to bite them at some time. I mean, it seems really strange. You'd think there'd be people who'd be up in arms about this. And I think people are starting to get upset about it.
I'm going to just do one more thing. I said we're wrapping up, but I just want to know, what is your impression of Ron DeSantis, having interacted with him at least several times?
I mean, I've never met a politician that like him. He's extraordinary. He called me out of the blue sometime in mid-September, like on a Sunday morning. I'm not sure exactly I got my number, but he called me up, said, would you like to speak to Governor DeSantis? I said, okay. And he'd read all, we had a two-hour conversation about COVID policy. This is September of last year, right? And he had read all the papers that I referenced, and not my work, but like lots and lots of other papers. He knew all of the details. It was a remarkable conversation. And then we had this like round table on September 25th with Martin and Mike Leavitt and with DeSantis leading it. And the next day he lifted most of the restrictions all across Florida. I mean, there's this like combination of like bravery, intellectual bravery, and also willingness to take a stand and sort of knowledge that I've never seen in a politician before.
Yeah. And I completely misjudged him. Initially, I thought he was like one of these jocks who, you know, gets into Yale and pulls C's and, you know, whatever. For some reason, I thought that. And now I really reproach myself for some reason having jumped to that conclusion, because when I saw the initial roundtable he did numerous months ago, I thought he was so informed, and without any notes, he was so informed about the literature. And I mean, now it's not that uncommon for people to know about the Iceland contact tracing study early on relating to schools and the spread and stuff. But, you know, he just knew that off the top of his head. For all these people criticizing him for not following the science or governors, or whatever, he could go up against any governor in the U.S., it seems to me.
You go up against epidemiologists. I mean, most epidemiologists don't know the literature as well as he does. I mean, I don't have enough words. I mean, I'm still stunned by it. I didn't know anything about him, actually, before September, really. I've just been very impressed.
Well, one way I know there won't be any other lockdowns in Florida, I mean, not only because the numbers seem to be trending down and we have reasons to think this thing is coming to an end or at least a manageable equilibrium, is that he's staked his entire political fortunes on there being no more lockdowns. There's no way. It's not like George Bush saying, read my lips, no new taxes. So that this is way beyond that. everything about Ron DeSantis now is that he is the guy who let Florida live. That's who he is.
Yeah, I think you're right. He's basically, like, I had a reporter ask me about him from Politico, and the sort of line the reporter was trying to give me was that he got lucky, that he turned out to be right ex post, but he got lucky. And, you know, I mean, like, you know, obviously there's great uncertainty about risks, about any policy of this kind of scope. But, you know, it's not actually luck. He was very, very well informed. And the policy that he adopted for his state, this focused protection policy, is robust to a lot of uncertainty. I mean, that's so, like, let's say the IFR is double what I think it is. Well, that, actually, still, focused protection is the right policy because you, as long as you have that age gradient in risk, the right thing to do is focused protection. It's robust to a very large number of, what if the herd immunity threshold is way higher than I think it is? Well, what's the right policy? Well, still, focused protection is the right policy, right? It doesn't matter what a lot of these scientific uncertainties are. By adopting a policy that's robust to scientific uncertainty, he's sort of inoculated himself against, in a sense, being wrong, because he's adopted a policy that will be right over a very broad range of the sort of scientific parameters. Whereas the lockdown folks, they're only right for a narrow set of scientific parameters, and those scientific parameters turn out to be not right. So I think, in a sense, he's not lucky. He actually is smart, and he really got the policy right by delving deep into the science.
Yeah, no kidding. And the thing is, though, despite all the confidence you might have in what you've been reading, he still must have had some sleepless nights, you know, when the Sun Belt spike was going on, maybe. And now that was probably before the full opening, but it was still somewhat open.
Yeah.
And he must have been wondering and second-guessing himself, at least in private, because you are dealing with people's lives here, but he stuck with it.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, he staked his career on this, right? I mean, I guess I staked my career on this too, right? But I think the key thing here is, like, why are we having... This is one of these things where, like, we're going to look back and just hang our heads and say, what do we do? Why does it require staking people's careers on this when what should have happened is a reasoned discussion in March about who's at risk and how do we protect them? I read a Washington Post piece by Mike Osterholm, who's like one of Joe Biden's advisors now, I think, on COVID, from, I think it was March, where he basically argued for the Great Barrington Declaration, March of last year. So I don't really understand. Even Fauci was in February was talking about it in sort of the more correct way. We just changed policy without a discussion, without actually thinking about what the risk profiles were and what the right thing to do based on those risk profiles. Older people are the most vulnerable. Why not work incredibly hard to protect them? Lockdowns are really going to be deadly. I mean, how could we not know that? I mean, that's a conversation that shouldn't have required people staking their career. That should have just been the outcome of a reasoned discussion at the beginning of the pandemic.
Yeah, that is indeed how it should have gone. I remember him saying, young people should go on that cruise. There's no reason they can't, but old people should think twice.
Yeah.
And then suddenly it was absolutely no one ever could go on any cruise, even as the numbers seemed to become less panic-inducing. Like, the more manageable it seemed to be, the crazier everybody became. I don't know what was going on there. But all the same, Jay Bhattacharya, I want to thank you for your time and also for being a quiet scientist who just wants to do his work, but who in this particular set of circumstances has risen to the occasion in ways that are probably not comfortable for you, but that are important for the rest of us.
Thank you, Tom. I really appreciate the words and appreciate the opportunity to talk with you.
All right, folks, that's going to do it for another week of episodes here on The Tom Woods Show. I don't know what's happening next week. I haven't got a single thing planned, but I know it'll be the usual quality you have come to expect. I'll see you then.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of The Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at Podsworth.com.